This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. I'm with Art Hovey and Warrington Kolsta, and we're at Dean Meeker's studio. And today is October 14th, 1994. This is a continuation of an interview started last month. Warrington, you had a first question.
Okay. To diverge just a little before we go back to talking about your work, Dean, and looking at some of your work, I thought the one person that we won't be able to interview in this project is Alfred Sessler. And so instead of an interview, to get some reactions from the people that we are able to talk to about Al and your relationship to him and various thoughts, you know, that observations, because I think you knew him very well.
Yeah. In
a relatively short time, but an important time.
Yes, I... with apartments, this is the end of the war, and they hadn't built anything in Madison but petitions for 4 years. And so places to live were hard to get, and studios were even harder. So Al and I had my first year here, Al and I had shared a studio in the old YMCA, which was at that time next to the Red Gym. It was between the Red Gym and the Union. And so I had an opportunity to get to know Al very well. And I must say, he was also, in some ways, a guide to my thoughts about teaching. I thought that he did an excellent job with the students. He would, meetings could go by and the dinners could be missed if some student had engaged him in in an inquiry about anything. You know? But he was, I thought, a very good teacher and an interesting man. He painted mostly in the studio we shared. Then later we shared, we moved kind of uptown from the YMCA over to the Quonset huts that were on the campus at that time. We shared studio there. And two different types of working people you couldn't find. He was a straightener and used to line up his brushes and leave the studio just immaculate. And of course, I was inclined to spread all over the place, and so I used to move one of his brushes just to, and he'd come in. He said, "Has anybody been in here?" But in all justice to him, he was a terrific teacher, and I had occasion. Do you remember his show in just the past few years that the Academy had?
Yes.
I had occasion to think about him in retrospect at that time, because I gave a little talk about his work, and he, of course, introduced lithography and etching. And I think, it would seem to me that his biggest contribution in the graphics field would be in woodcut. He developed a way of reduction printing, which was really, you had to think about it. It was a little like blockout and silkscreen, but you would get the design onto the block and cut out part of it, and you had to really think ahead. You would start with light colors, and then the last key block, of course, would be the block with the most detail, and the same block many times. Sometimes he would use alternate blocks, but the idea was to reduce the the surface, the relief surface that was being inked each time. And it occurred to me then that this kind of technical challenge was very interesting to students. Students got hooked in on this because he had examples, of course, and sequence developments, and staying out of his subject matter, although that was very interesting, is his technical forte, I think, was communicating these things to students. He had, he got the first litho presses, and the first that big iron number, what is that, the Sturgis press.
Two of those, I think he had.
And he had all those in a little room over in the old education building.
Yeah.
And there were considerable debates among people who were teaching that the importance of this, and I must say Al just hung in there, and we got our first then major graphic studio when we moved to the education building out of the old engineering building. And by being early in the rush, he was able to lay out some place in the basement. In those days, graphic studios always had to be in the basement because of the weight of the presses. You couldn't have them big, heavy presses on the fifth floor or something, at least not in an old building. And so it was the same fate at Iowa and many other universities that I visited, that they were always on the ground floor or lower because of the old heavies that they depended on for the for printing.
Was he supportive when you opened your serigraphy studio?
I would say so, yeah. He, I always had the feeling he was a little bit like, well, many people thought about serigraphy at that time as not quite art. It had been a poster invention, and there were many, as I said last time, there were many shows. I remember being stung by this that would say boldly in their circulating material for a show that no silk screens or monotypes.
Photographs
too. So that, and how that has changed, of course, is amazing. Yes, I would say Al was supportive. But like I say, that was something that didn't happen in the same room with the etching, certainly. Our needs were different, our equipment was lighter.
You could go on the fourth floor.
Right, so I went up to the fourth floor, and that was fine too, except that toxic fumes and whatnot, we had to always take little packages with us out of the building at night, so because it not only is toxic paint, but you have to use turpentine and so
flammable.
And so we always had students carrying out little bundles to the dumpster. Because if you left them in there, you'd come in Monday morning and they'd be, you know, smoking. So we were very careful about
that. I can remember many smoking trash cans.
Yeah. Yes, that was, and I got a room that was, in those days, everybody had a pet project, the jewelers, the sculptors, the ceramic people. And it was like land grabs, you know. If you got to notice that something was coming up, there would be an immediate move to get this for your own discipline. But The one on fourth floor, because there I was sort of, I could reasonably equip it, except for air extractors. We had nothing in the way of safe air. I don't know how. I was thinking yesterday when I was using that nitric on for patinas. I spent my whole life in toxic materials, and I just I don't know how I've escaped it.
Well, at least in the summer, you had these big windows.
Yes. Yeah. Now you got.
Then winter would close you down, and you
right.
And you were in the fumes.
Well, you took your choice. You either stayed warm, or you had fresh air. And depending how intense it got, you'd make the choice accordingly.
This is becoming a recurring theme. Have you noticed the circulation?
It's very real.
Toxicity of the art environment.
Well, I think it's over.
Social and technical.
I think it's somehow overdone now. I see they have a book now that about the materials of art and what is dangerous and what and when you start warning students about walnut chips, you know, I mean, they're going to get so afraid to touch anything, you know.
But, you know, the good things that have come out of all of this is that there are standards and products are labeled.
Yes.
So that, you know, you can guard yourself if it says, you know, don't eat it, don't breathe it, or
don't have small
rub it on you. You know not to do that. Whereas initially, these cans and solvents and lacquer thinners and poisonous stuff that we use, they were just in the public domain.
I painted with lacquer in this studio I shared with Al,
yeah.
And we just couldn't be in the studio at the same time. Fortunately, we had alternating programs. So, but he'd come in and he'd smell this stuff and he'd open all the windows. But Al was, I think, a very good teacher. He was a dedicated teacher. I have some of his lithos. They were interesting in their reflection. In a way, they were social statements, but they were, he, I think, used social statements much as I use mythology. It's a structure to hang what you want to do on it and go
now,
from
did
there.
Some of that relate to his Milwaukee experience? Santo, of course, talks about their mutual involvement in some of these causes.
Right. And, of course, Al was, I think he thought about these things, but he was a go-along personality. He would go to the picture shows with people and then sleep through the whole thing, you know. He loved to be with people. He disliked being alone, and he would, that's what I've always thought about his political activities in Milwaukee. I wasn't there, but it seems that that Al would, you know, they're going to a meeting, well, he'd go too, you know, and it wasn't a matter of political conviction, it was a matter of being social.
Yeah. He was a very warm person. He was a warm, social person. He truly liked people, and he liked to kind of explore them, explore their minds, and I think that's one reason he was so good with students.
Right.
You said he was a good teacher. What were his strengths as a teacher?
I don't know, an infinite capacity to take, to entertain their ideas and discuss it with them. He had, of course, a whole background of technical things that he knew, but his feeling about this was, again, it was social. He was with people, but he was with people for a purpose, and he could, he did indeed teach etching, and he did teach lithography, all having a lot of technical know-how, technical material to learn, I should say. And this, the woodblock and its development, I think are mainly his, to me at least, his strongest contribution to graphics. I was very impressed, and seeing them at the time I spoke of him at the academy, seeing them again after 25 years, I was reminded that these are pretty pretty comprehensive and technically superb pieces.
Yeah, he still looks very good, which reminded me at one of the College Art Association meetings about 4 years ago in Houston. Sylvia Solacek gave a presentation. I mean, she was one of his students, and she's now, I think she's dean at the San Francisco State University, and also a prominent printmaker using the same techniques that Sessler did, the wood relief prints. And so she was looking at this period, you know, the 60s, and she gave a talk on it with slides, and there was Leonard Baskin, and people whose prints you hadn't seen for a little while, and my God, they look strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, she gave, you know, these prints by slides looked magnificent, and there was a Sessler, and it was, you know, it really looked great.
Yeah.
It looked better
yeah.
than my memory.
Yeah. Well, big too. They it
big,
helps.
Yeah, the light and things. But you know, it really stood right up there with Baskin and people that had continued their reputation on longer.
Particularly in his work with color, I thought was very, very impressive.
Okay, we're back. I listened to most of your interview from about a month ago, where you were talking about your background and your trip to Chicago and your education there, and the first part is a little bit still a little bit of a blank for me. You said that you started out as a sign painter, working with a sign painter who had a drinking problem, and then your principal wrote you this really nice letter and helped you get into the Art Institute. When did you? What you didn't talk about is when you first started to realizing you had artistic talent, or it started it first started to develop within you. Did you have anybody in your family or anyone who encouraged it, or did you just sort of discover this on your own?
Well, this is a theory I have that may not have any real validity, but when you don't spell well and you can't add a column of figures, you look to the things that you can do. And that was more or less... I had made a mess of high school, and it was my misfortune to have been, I was 6 foot and pretty heavy, and my algebra teacher just straight out told me if I didn't go out for football, I was going to flunk algebra, and I mean, he was straight out about it, so I tried, but all those dirty uniforms, and I decided against this, and I actually didn't graduate from high school. I'm one of the few full professors I know that doesn't have a high school diploma. I was thinking about going back and getting the equivalency, but but that was what made it so interesting, at least in retrospect, that my high school principal, in spite of all the things that I was variously accused of and was literally thrown out. In spite of this, there's nothing like a reform student, you know. They're almost better than students who paid attention all along. And so he wrote around to art schools all over the country, And one, he wanted to get a good art school for me, and two, he wanted them not to require me to have a high school diploma. So he was very important in this, and I was working in a sign company, and but I just couldn't see myself being a sign painter the rest of my life. And my master, the master sign maker, was, if he was my goal, I wasn't quite sure. I could see myself doing it, but I didn't want to. So I sold my car, quit my girl, and hitchhiked to Chicago.
Had there been an art class in your high school?
Yes. There was an art teacher that he held forth in the fourth floor again, and there was a part of that that was undeveloped, and I used to hide in there and do art while other classes were going on. And Mr. Bailey, he did kind of interesting watercolors or something, but he was a good teacher. And in that, he protected me from the, the realities of high school. I suppose contributed to my downfall. But
did you do any like publication work, the school, like the school yearbook? And
no, I was remote from the spirit of the high school, I guess. No, I didn't do any of that until I got to the. I guess you could say that we used to do the outdoor bulletins, paper bulletins, on companies that would do, say, editions of eight for outdoor signs. You can't set up an offset litho, not like national beer ads or something. So. I remember we had one laurel leaf gasoline, and so we would have the master on a big window like this, and then we would pull paper across it and copy these. And I got very good at that, very fast, actually. And so I suppose if there is when I became very good at this, I suppose that kind of clued me in, and I was making $2 an hour when 50 cents was the going rate for somebody my age and education. So I got pretty good at that. But you know, what's what's to do but follow what's under there, you know.
I'm curious about the printmaking experience at the Chicago Art Institute. Because I feel I was influenced by the Chicago Art Institute in that at Berkeley there were no prints. No, I never had any instruction in prints, but when I was working with Fred Heidel and his wife in Long Beach, they were products of the Art Institute, and I know you knew them.
Right.
And they were both doing prints. Fred was doing silk screens, and his wife was doing relief prints. And I picked up doing prints from them. Fred showed me how to make screens, how to stretch the silk and all that, and got me going.
Well, my experience was different. The graphics department was... well, they had litho stuck in a little room, and they had etching stuck in a little room, and I didn't know that there was anything at the school to do with silkscreen. Etchings were things you did mostly, I thought of it at the time, as something you did if you wanted to illustrate books. You know, they were all, everybody had a small portfolio that they carried them in, but... No, I would say that I was more interested in the bombast of painting at that time, and inadvertently got involved in silkscreen by putting myself through school with it. I worked in commercial shops, and did a lot of more printing than I'd care to think of. At night, I worked in a shop that ran from 4 until 10 or 12, and there too we gassed ourselves every night. But my only silkscreen experience was outside of school, and I didn't see anything. Of course, I should back up a little. Schneewen, who was the curator of the graphics collection, was
the Art Institute.
Yes, was very. He got me interested, and then later, after I'd been here for a few years, he had the first silkscreen show that they'd had in the Art Institute with my prints. So that was the graphics, I would say, came through their collection. And I can remember as a student seeing Goya's and Rembrandt self-portraits ad infinitum. I used to get out the whole box, and that was a kind of unique thing. That wasn't trendy. I mean, the graphics weren't something that that the cafeteria was alive with talk about. It was the romance of painting and keeping a steady eye on the horizon. And
yeah, you have this wonderful resource out there, the collection.
Right, the collection.
Which was very strong in prints.
Right, and then Joachim, I guess.
Joachim
was later. But Schneewen, at the time I showed him my silkscreen prints that I had done, he said, "I've just never seen anything like this. I've never." Of course, that may speak to the limitation of his interest, but he had a show which I thought would be, that's what really got me to thinking about graphics. I had a show that I thought, wow, you come back to your own institute or your own school and have a show, that's wonderful. I thought of it strictly as, some kind of an honor, which it was, but I also sold about half the show, and they have a graphics club, and they commissioned the first, they do 100 prints for members, the print members, and so I did the first silkscreen that they had, their membership had acquired, so... That was a real kick.
The breakthrough.
Yeah. But the silkscreen, as I said before, was I wanted nothing more than to forget about the whole experience of commercial silkscreen. I just, it was headachy. I was working late at night, and that's when the students found this out somehow, and I denied it, but we did set up a silkscreen class, and at first a non-credit course. I thought maybe I could take a few of these people and just teach them silkscreen, and we wouldn't. But the classes got to 15, and Logan said, "You better write up a description on this because you're using heat, light, gas, whatnot to teach these courses. They should be described." And so we made it official. We had described it and put it into the curriculum.
Your other teaching, were you teaching paintings?
Painting, life drawing. Occupational therapy, whatever was left over in the 50s.
Load,
yeah,
really.
Right. Anything that was left over, the younger people got. And as you say, 4 classes sometimes. And design, too. I was talking about this to my helper. And because a friend of his had gotten to teach design, and I said, has anyone ever clearly defined what design is? I remember I was doing one thing, and Warrington was having showing them the, I guess, the relationship of form and function, and they built kites, and if they didn't fly, they didn't get a grade,
right.
Which I was impressed with that because it was right. It was the
it was a kite. The
wind did the critique, you know.
Did the higher one?
Right, right. Naturally. But I'd never seen a successful course in design, because we were all grappling for what to teach in design. But that was a good out. We were all seeking various solutions. And then we also were teaching, Zingali and I had never had courses in perspective, and we were teaching. We would study this almost together and quiz each other about the rules of perspective. We managed to stay a couple of jumps ahead of the students, but I think it changed both our lives.
Yeah, it was an interesting mix of people in the early days of the department, because you were struggling with perspective, and I know I struggled with it too when I taught drawing, because I had never seen people who were so obsessed with perspective as some of the other staff members, such as John Wilde.
Yeah.
Who in many aspects of his drawing class, it was like engineering drawing.
Right.
Right. He would set up these elaborate projects in perspective. His students would go to the Historical Society and have to draw a stairway in God knows how many point perspective that was. But you were conscious of the diversity of background of the people that you were studying with.
John was, we agreed, and it keeps him busy. You know? But I had a course at that time. We had this, as I spoke of before, we had this influx of GIs, and so on one of these perspective problems, you know, this kid comes in, well, I thought he was my age, and he looked around and left. And I thought, oh boy, you know, I saw that. The next morning he throws the whole thing on my desk and says, what's next, professor? You know, he said, it turned out that he'd been on a war restorations team and could move in and do a cathedral and what happened to it in 20 minutes, you know? I said, perhaps we can get other problems for you. And the final thing in this was, and I studied it out, and it was, I suppose that's why I've always been affectionate about spiral staircases. I got the formula for, and worked out the formula on a spiral staircase, and any students that became troublesome by getting ahead of everybody else, I would throw them this problem on them. And I would take care of them, because it's very complicated. You project a circle down so that you can find out exactly where the steps come. And but you don't coach them on this. You just give them the problem. You know, those were great, the early days here. And speaking, we were speaking of Moore a minute ago. I once taught, I guess I taught everything but jewelry. I taught sculpture and figure modeling. And then we had the OTs, which we called odd types, which were the occupational therapy people. And Della Wilson was at one table, and I was at another table. And with the same, we had 40 of these people. And she was having them pull the, take the clay and pull the doggy legs out and the tail. And I thought, you know, how simple-minded. And I was showing them slides of Henry Moore and all these great sculptors. Well, the plain fact was that she was getting a better product than I was. So I modified my teaching approach. It in those days you thought that you were going to turn everybody into professional sculptors or artists, and I was so it took a few years to become disillusioned enough to know that at least they would at best they would become functioning teachers on an elementary or secondary level. That was part of the function of the school. And I remember my interview, Mrs. Annan said, "Well, did you ever take education courses?" And I, as though being accused of wasting my time, said, "Certainly not." And then as I went out of the building, I see across the top, art education. And I thought, well, there's another interview that's gone.
And the occupational therapy was one of the great successes,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
I think that developed into a great area of study.
Right.
And I think that it washed back all kinds of credit on the School of Education.
Right, and we got, there was an enrollment that just,
yeah.
60 little girls wanting to know how to amuse therapy, occupational therapy people, and it was a problem. But I got better at it. Finally, we had them carving salt and
fly tying.
Directly functional. You did fly tying?
We did fly tying, yes.
Did you have to catch a fish to pass the course?
No, those were flies that never saw the water. But,
yeah.
They were fantastic.
And if they'd have just laid there.
Yeah. I found the teaching was very much like the teaching that I'd done in the Army, where, you know, I was always, basically, in the Army, I taught. And I taught things I knew nothing about.
Right.
I would read my manual that night, and then I would teach, you know, the 50 caliber machine gun.
Right. Right.
And so it was teaching the occupational therapy people was the same.
Well, and simple materials, though, materials that are readily gotten a hold of. That's why this rock salt project went over so well, and that and the fact that if they washed it enough, they let the water run over it enough, that it would begin to look indeed like a Henry Moore.
I didn't hear about the rock salt.
Well, that was, we were trying to think of materials that they could get that they wouldn't have to go to an art store, and cardboard and many glues and putting structures together in 3D. It was helpful to me because it was a constant. I used to get so tired from teaching, and just this constant involvement. I used to have to take a nap like I do now. I would go home and take a nap and come back because you were so busy with your figuring out how you were going to get these things across. And
did you have graduate students from early on? When did you begin to get graduates?
I guess when I got us the specialization of silkscreen. You didn't get many in beginning drawing and painting, and I would say that probably the first graduate students I had were in graphics and some sculpture.
What year was that about?
Well, I have a chronology here. Maybe I better look at it to establish exactly where 7. Some of these are surprisingly early. I was startled to find I have a friend who's interested, a very close friend who's interested in stained glass. So we're doing two stained glass windows of the print Joseph's Coat, which is a perfect for stained glass.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I hadn't realized that it was this back in the 70s when I did this. This print is older.
Yeah.
Yes. Began non-credit instruction in silkscreen, 1949. What was your question?
When did you start? I think you just answered.
Yeah.
When did you start having graduate students?
Right. Began in 49 and 50. In 54 I got the grant awarded to a member in the studio art by the graduate school, and that was related to silkscreen. I simply thought at that time that the methods that I had were mostly pro film and things that were I knew from commercial art, and I knew there must be better ways to do it than that. So I had a semester to work out some of the techniques, transferring things to the silk by, we learned a new, very fancy word, fromontage, rubbing, doing rubbings on the silk, and various resist techniques. That is, you put litho crayon or ordinary kids crayons onto the silk. We worked directly because we didn't have, there was some photo silk screen, but not a lot. And so there were various techniques that would seem to represent more of a graphic interest in silk screen rather than a poster. That, of course, was all turned around by Worrell. But we strive to not so much to look like silkscreen as to look like the more the better thought of etching and other techniques. As a matter of fact, some of them look kind of like etchings, you know, which I
probably a good time.
I have some early and middle and development work that might.
I'm gonna start off by taking this off,
okay.
And then you guys move over there, and I'll figure out a way of getting this over.
Peter was here and stayed at the studio, and I had a party. Were you at the party at the house? You were probably a lot of years
we
didn't see each other here.
I know.
I
think that was the travel.
But he came here, and Bill taught me some things, and one of them was that you should always have your prints with you. You know, he came to this party that was given for him with a roll of prints under his arm, and by gosh, if he didn't sell two or three while he was there. I'm not sure, I may have gotten this at the time. Can't register?
Yeah,
please. I don't know, I had in mind working at Haters because that was the, was a very well-known, if not famous, Atelier 17 in Paris, where again, a lot of the GIs had studied, and for a certain kind of attitude towards graphics. And also, I think I got a lot from him and technical facilities. Earlier on, he had experimented, and I have one of these experiments that takes it a little outside of his usual work, in that it is this
when I told him what I was doing and combining silkscreen with intaglio, he says, yes, we did that many years ago. And he's English, and he's very aware of his prerogatives. And so this is, in fact, a print of his, where this color, green and the red, were put on, not on the paper, but on the plate. He silkscreened onto the plate, and I said, how did you do that, since it silkscreen paint dries almost immediately because it goes through such a fine sieve? And he said, well, we had to put extenders in it, and that meant some non-drying oil, you know. And Lord knows technically what happened, but I thought it was interesting. He did, in fact, and you get resultant colors, running purple over green. You get this deep, deep color, and the orange here, and then the press the plate that was deeply bitten, and I think it was the process of printing. He used to line up the students and have them each do with viscosity printing too. He would have them all handle one, be responsible for one color, and they would go along, and then they would run it out. And that's when he had all these viscosity rollers out that he offered me the opportunity of trying them and cleaning up. So that's this is a this is. I found the atelier to be somewhat limited in they had no aqua tint, their presses were in bad shape, the plumbing had all been eaten out by putting nitric acid in the sinks, and so I found that I was living on the same street with Kaiko Moti, who was Kaiko Badamoti Wala was his complete name. And he had been a Haider Massier helper, runner of the shop. And he this, of course, predates some of Haider's viscosity prints. But it's clearly Moti had worked this out, and it remains to the historians of printmaking to figure out who did it first. But I'd be inclined, since Moti was given to complicated printing, I would. Of course, they both were. So, but as you can see, this is the deepest part, which of course registers as the highest part here. But the deepest part of the plate was had red in it, and then wiped. In other words, a deep intaglio was filled with red. It was then removed and two rollers, one tan and then the last one in blue, and he would go across these with big rollers, and in order not to lift the tan, you put just a little bit more oil. When you put out the colors and mix them, you put Haider used to say a dollar's worth, well, a size of a dollar, yeah. Right. And so if you do the tan with $1, you would do the blue, which went over it, and you can tell the precession here, would have $2. And that way, if these two sticky inks are not of the same viscosity, they don't stick to each other. One is more fluid, and if you go on with this, you finally get so that it's so fluid that it won't stick to any of it. But this is just an example of a three-stage viscosity print. Well, I found Kaiko to be less restricting, and so I sort of insinuated myself into his studio. I didn't insinuate myself. I had to teach him silkscreen. So we traded on this. And later, well, I'll talk about that. at the same time I was in Paris, did you meet Friedlander?
Yes, I did. I didn't know him well, but I didn't know him well either,
but Aquatint came to my attention. And so that was I at least found out about it, and that was something that if you did in Hayter's studio only got you a lot of difficulty, because they had no Aquatint box, so you were left to take a bag and shake, and of course this stuff will settle down all over the shop. I wasn't run out, but there were some strong suggestions that I should do it elsewhere. And, so that was one of the things that...
Now, was this on your Guggenheim year?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that was 59-60. And there's a build-up in chronology before I had gone to Paris. I had worked with Mish Cohn. Getting back to Al again, was inclined to be covetous of the shop to other faculty members. It was a little... so the way we worked around that was that we suggested to him that any number of faculty members by that time had had a grant, and that he should apply for one. So he applied for one and got it, and we got him out of the shop for a whole summer. And that summer, they got in to do the teaching. They got in Mish Cohn, and we not only he had a whole vocabulary of technical things that I was very interested in. This is a sugar lift, but it's printed on the relief rather than the intaglio. He would do them both ways. He would put the, in other words, this with the whites here would be black if you reversed the printing. But you know, the whole idea of playing with the topography of a plate began to come through with me, to me, and he was just wonderful. And also his Schinkole experiments that he was working on that summer. It was a great summer. We had classes in the morning and then threw everybody out, and he and I worked in that room every afternoon during the summer, and it was a marvelous experience. So that then, these are student friends. What you've got here, I'll get back to those.
Watch the art.
This is, I had mentioned before, Bob Hodgel, and he was doing watercolors. I see now he's doing some ceramic sculpture that I was a little disappointed in, knowing his abilities, but maybe he's just... But he called me on the telephone one time from Florida and said, "How do you do a silk screen?" So it's his call. I took about a half an hour to tell him about it, and in 2 weeks' time, he sent me this. He was, as I pointed out earlier, the assistant to Curry, and a very, very, I thought, good artist. He did watercolors. He did big paintings.
He did a lot of relief prints.
Right, the one of Moses in the burning bush that...
big, black and whites.
Right.
They are with a little red or something. Right.
These are some, I've got some big Nelsons, but it's a litho. As a matter of fact, we tried to hire him.
Yes.
Remember he was here?
Yes,
and something happened to that.
I think it was the girl he brought.
Maybe.
I think.
I didn't know that one.
I don't know. My memory gets dim in this, but I remember there was a party, and essentially we invited all these people to meet him. And he came kind of in costume, Western costume.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he was traveling with this young girl. I think that a lot of people had a negative.
Right. His student or ours?
Well, it was his.
Well, these are... This is a bit disjointed, but I got this in Mexico. All through the Mayan ruins, I lusted to do a rubbing. And I was even trying to figure out how I could carry a rolled up piece of paper in a hollow cane and then get in there, because I knew they would object to it. But at Chichen Itza, this guy had all kinds of these. And I said, how did you do that? I mean, how did you get in to do that? He says, my brother-in-law is a guard. But they're kind of nice.
Yeah.
I got a bunch of them. And then a sort of a flip back in the 60s, in 70s, in 72, I was a consultant. I touched on that before. I was a consultant to a firm in Chicago that manufactured pictures. They were really selling frames, but they had to put pictures in them, and I showed them how to do it. So, and in turn learned a great deal about photographic methods. But I had them buy some of Moti's things outright, and then I guaranteed him that I would see that they were produced properly. This is a watercolor. Of a watercolor. And it's a silk screen that we developed in Chicago. Here it shows you where it, the reading on what exposures to use. And this is two colors, blue and brown. And then printed transparent looked really like, well, that's the same. Very proud of that one. Anyway, while we were in, this gives a little back to Moti again. In order to work in his studio, we alternated days of being master. He says to my master, that was on the off day when I taught him silkscreen. And then he would teach. And of course, we abused each other on the days that we were the master by having him clean up, and I always had to clean up after him, and on the days I was the student. But this was a simple, I knew I had to do this quickly because I wanted to find out a lot about printing, and he just had a kind of peripheral interest in silk screen. So I just had him take a screen and do a painting in tush on it, which he did in 10 minutes. And that was the way that we did this. That was a resist, this tush was a resist, and you pulled glue across it, glue Page's animal glue, and then you would wash out the tush with turpentine so that you kept them, the two of them apart, and you then print the brown through the openings. Does that follow? And then I took that screen and pulled lacquer across it, filling in the brown, but then I washed the background out with water. And the lacquer, of course, the whole game was to keep one chemical from dissolving another, or relying on it dissolving another. So I then printed the green. So it's a two-color, one-drawing arrangement. So that was the sort of thing that we played.
It's a marvelous example, creating with the process.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's not exactly drawing, but you make an image through your manipulation of the process itself.
Right. Yeah, well, those were awe-inspiring days between Hayter and the whole of Paris print scene, Friedlander, and also knew
Krishna Reddy,
It was a very, very exciting.
How were Modi's relationships to Hayter? Did he had left? He was no longer working for Hayter, but did he have a good relationship with him?
No. You see, when they both claimed viscosity as their own, Hayter threw him out.
Yeah.
So by the time I came there, Reddy was his new massier, and Keiko wasn't allowed near the place. And so Hayter was writing his book, and he simply stated that he invented it, and that's the way, you know, when you write a book about it, it must be true.
It was in place. And then, of course, Krishna also claimed that he invented it, that he invented it with Modi. He always gave Modi some credit.
Right.
But he maintained a close relationship with Hayter, even so.
Right.
He was a little cautious with his claims.
Well, they were great days. Upon return, in the development of the